When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
You're listening to The Tillage Podcast with the Irish Farmers Journal.
Hello, everyone. It's Thursday, the 21st of April, 2022, and you're listening to The Tillage Podcast. I'm Stephen Robb, and as always, I'm joined by my colleagues Andy Doyle and Siobhan Walsh to run through your key tillage news stories of the week. Guys, so straight into it this week. So, Siobhan, you've been out and about on the road and in the fields. What have you been seeing?
Oh, plenty, Stephen. I suppose crops are flying and generally in very good order. So like spring barley crops, I think, you know, a lot are up now and some at the tree leaf stage and moving further on. Even establishment generally, you know, looks to be very good. And I suppose all early sown, so no aphicide due. So, you know, no panic with getting out on sprayers to them until the weeds get established properly. Winter barley looks to be just flying through growth stages. You know, I saw crops of winter barley with awns starting to peep this week, but certainly a lot of crops hitting flag leaf or flag leaf emerging. And I suppose people might be under pressure to get their tarpal out. So just to, I suppose, keep an eye on that growth stage there so that you don't miss your time. And I think crops in general look clean, like winter wheats are hitting for their T1. And I think Andy might talk more on the wheat later, but crops in general look very clean. What I did notice when I was driving around, like, I know, like, it's the time of year where we see the oilseed rape in flower, but I certainly think there looks to be more oilseed rape planted, and I think people definitely took advantage of those higher prices and took a sensible decision to plant more. I know we won't know for definite until the BPS, but it certainly looks that way out in the roads and in the fields. And I suppose this week I saw a nice bit of maize going in I think, like, I didn't see any spuds this week. The only place I saw spuds was I was watching the Grand National on Monday, and I saw a few people, I think they were planting spuds, taking a break to watch the Grand National in the background. But I think spuds is kind of wrapping up, but I know you'll know more on that, Stephen.
Yeah, and what about beet? I know there's a lot of beet going in places far south, but I'd imagine a lot of guys still holding off.
Yeah, I think people have been holding off. I haven't seen beet going in yet. And I know there is some going in, but I think people have been holding off. I did see a good lot of grass, sprayed off our crops. I saw a few crops planted into grass this week, but I don't know, the ones that are sprayed off now are probably destined for reseed. I don't know that it may, unless maybe it's people taking advantage of the tillage incentive scheme and going in with beet or maize maybe still.
Andy, you were also on the road this week. Where were you and what did you see?
Yeah, Stephen, I went down to look to see what was happening specifically in crops in South Wexford. So you, in true tradition, still look out the window as you're driving down along. And, the story is exactly as Siobhan has given it, pretty well across the board. There's a broad range of growth stages in all crops, but most of them conform to flag leaf emerged on winter barley, even though there is slightly more forward and they're slightly behind that as well. And winter wheat generally running to 31 But certainly some crops running a little bit beyond that at this point in time. You know, just what you're kind of seeing driving along, I saw, you know, a lot of lovely crops, spring crops, as Siobhan said, very well established. I would say the rain and the showers and the way they fell was absolutely ideal for very high levels of establishment in spring crops. And hopefully it'll stand to them for the rest of the year to have high populations and uniform populations from the word go. So an occasional field with nitrogen spreading problems, and I wouldn't like to blame either the spreader or the operator. And I just wonder, like, would there be problems that are relating almost specifically to fertilizer quality in the year that's in it? And I would say that's likely. Not easy to undo when the main split at growth stage 31 throws up a problem. But anyway, the problems are there. You could see them going around, but relatively few, thankfully. After that, I suppose the things that I maybe was hoping I wouldn't see would be barley yellow dwarf virus. And I know from talking to people all across the south of the country over the past week, 10 days, that barley yellow dwarf is a lot more prevalent than most people would like to see it at the moment.
In winter barley crops
specifically, yeah. Patches becoming relatively big within fields, and not only that, but aphids visibly now multiplying in those infected patches, which means they're feeding on plants that carry virus. And when they get to the point of moving, as in when populations build, if populations build, they will move directly onto spring crops. So it's one of those kind of catch 22 situations. Do you spray, do you not spray? In some instances, I would hope that if you were to spray a winter crop where you have populations building, that you might act to significantly reduce the pressure on your spring crop. That's true in theory, but if somebody else has a virus problem who doesn't do it, then you're still probably going to get caught by it. So one doesn't necessarily solve the other. Other things that I was finding an amount of crown rust, indeed quite a lot of crown rust, on some of the autumn sown oat crops that I was in. The crops actually that I was in, they were quite variable, going from single stems at maybe growth stage 31 to single stems with flag leaf emerging. And you could see the difference in the field. And generally speaking, the healthier the plant, the more advanced it was, and the healthier it was, the less crown rust that was on it. So there was something else going on in the background. It could be hunger, stress. It looked a little bit of a hungry crop, but certainly there was something else going on in those fields. The other one then was brown rust, quite evident on winter barley. And, you know, I'd certainly be advising anybody to make sure that whatever products you're using in your program on winter barley, that it would cover brown rust, and to check whether brown rust was very active at the time of spraying or just present at the time of spraying. If it's very active, you need a bit more vump in the tank to knock it back quickly, because if we're going into a spell of warmer weather, it can actually build quite quickly and quite surprisingly if you're not aware of it.
So as Siobhan was saying, though, in terms of winter barley, you know, stages are quite varied, as in some crops have yet to receive their T1, whereas some are about to receive their T2. So I guess, should growers be looking out for, whereabouts did you see the rust in the winter barley, out of curiosity? That was South Wexford, was it?
That was South Wexford, yes. But all winter barley I was in last week and this week in different parts of the country, if you go into a number of crops, there's brown rust in some of them. So I would say the risk is everywhere.
Yeah, so in other words, adjust your T1 or T2 accordingly.
Well, I'm not saying adjust. I'm saying look and see. And if you have it, then you may need to adjust. But you do need to know whether you're dealing with it. Like, not every variety will get brown rust bad. But if you have it, and in particular, if you're spraying at a time when the disease is very active and you're seeing new lesions popping up, then you need to put a bit of morpholine in the tank just to put the handbrake on it a lot faster.
So Andy, maybe, you know, this week, people who are between their first and their second spray, if they are going with a grow reg this week, you know, maybe they should be looking for the brown rust and putting the morpholine in the tank.
Yes, Siobhan, yes. And yeah. But probably with something else. Like morpholine as a fungicide probably give you about 10 days control or cover, whereas you tend to expect about 20, 21, 23 days out of most other products that we use in the mix. So, but the morpholines, they work a lot faster. And that's where when you're dealing with rust, which moves so rapidly, we've always had an advantage of putting it into the tank, providing it's moving rapidly. If temperature stays slow, well, then rust will be moving much slower than the growth of the plant itself. So it's less of an issue. But if it's visibly active, and the quick way of looking at that, just rub your finger on a leaf where you can see the lesions. If your finger is bringing up the brown pustules, the colour off the leaf, that disease is moving and moving fairly rapidly.
Okay, where are we at with winter wheat in terms of timings? Are we seeing any T1s on yet?
Well, we're seeing T1. Yes, we're seeing some T1s on, and we're seeing T1s going on. You know, probably a lot of people targeting next week, or maybe even later this week for T1s, because there's been a visible burst of growth and extension in the last couple of days. It's you know, the heat and the sun is really driving crops on. But like, you know, the correct timing for T1 is when the third last leaf is fully unfolded. And just in conversation with people are saying, look, it's next week and I'm going with T1s. And I'm saying, well, you know, where are you on growth stage? And the comment would come back, I know I'll be a little earlier, so I'll have to worry about the interval, but I'm still going. And I'm saying, you know, I think that's really bad husbandry. I think I would much prefer to be going a little late with a T1 rather than a little early, because that gap in the middle between the T1 and the T2, if you're waiting for the flag leaf to be fully unfolded, that's a much more vulnerable stage of growth. And if you have to fill it with a stopgap fungicide, what do you use that's not going to cause you to use, say, a third SDHI, a strob, which is more expensive, which is limited in its activity, a triazole, where you're really only using one to begin with, or maybe a second now with Revisol. So it's not easy to look towards a program with the possibility of building in a fourth stopgap spray on wheat. It's asking for trouble in the long term in my book. So I'd much prefer to make sure that the timing was either right or a little bit later than right. And with a range of varieties on a lot of farms, generally they give you a little bit more flexibility, as well as sowing, they're giving you a little bit of flexibility. So that to me is key.
Okay. And look, Andy, you have that, or you're writing about that on the tillage pages this week, and indeed you're writing about rust on the tillage pages as well. So be sure to check that out. But we're going to move on in the interest of time. And Siobhan, we finally have an update about malt and barley price from Bort Malt this week.
Yeah, Stephen, the secret's out. And I don't know what all the secrecy was about, because there was a great price this week. So basically, we know now that averaging has started. For some of our listeners that don't know, the Bort Malt price since 2019, the harvest price is based on the average free on board Crail price from France for Planet malt and barley. It's based on the dried price. So the harvest price here in Ireland, the green price, is based on the French dried price. From that price at the close of business every Wednesday is taken from mid-April to mid-September, and it's an average over those weeks is taken as the harvest price. So the price this week where it started is 400 euro per ton. And I suppose that was up 21 euro on the week before. So it had taken a significant jump last week, I actually don't know. It's Thursday morning now, and I don't know where the price finished on Wednesday. So it's the same. It's kind of the same issue. We still don't have access to that price. But hopefully, we'll get access to that price later on today. And we'll try and keep our readers informed as we go along. But I suppose just to put that price into perspective, so. Growers had opportunities to fix their malt and barley price, so they could fix 40% of their contracted tonnage. So some would have fixed at a price of 250 euro a ton, and some would have fixed at a price of 270 euro per ton. So if you fixed 20% at 250, 20% at 270, and let's say the harvest price averages out at 400, then that brings your providing 100% of your malt and barley passes, mm-hmm. that brings your price to €344 a ton at the end of the year for all your malt and barley. But look, we don't know where that price is going to go. We don't know where the average is going to end up, whether it'll be up or down. But just, I suppose, going an, another step, if your malt and barley doesn't pass and you have 40% sold at that average of 260, then your first, so let's say you have 100 tons of barley contracted to Bourke Malt, so the first 40 ton you'll be paid €260 a ton in, so the first 40 ton that passes over the weighbridge. And then if only, let's say only another 20 ton passes, then you'll be paid the average FOB Creil price. So that, let's say if that finished at 400, you'd be paid 400 on that 20 ton. And then, you know, obviously the rest of your 40% doesn't pass. So just that farmers are aware that that's how it happens, that you don't get, you know, it's not an average of all three prices together. Your 40% that you have fixed, that'll be the price that you get on the first 40% over the weighbridge.
My God. So in other words, if only 40% of your crop passes, you'd be much better off with 100% of it failing.
Yeah, because I'd have to do the maths on that. Yeah, but
because the feed price is likely to be much higher than 260.
Yeah, or else you would have been better to not fix any at all. Which, look, I think that's wrong too, because I think farmers who fixed at those prices of 250 and 270 have to be happy with those prices. It was a sensible, good business decision to make at the time. 250 and 270 were good prices, and people tried to lock in at those because they bought fertilizer at that time as well. And I think people who have taken those prices should just, you know, be happy and move on from them. But look, I'm just pointing out so people know what's going to happen as the season goes on.
Yeah. No, that, I mean, that's a good explanation, and it's good to know that. I still think, though, that if only 40%, I mean, we've seen the uproar in terms of fixed pricing in the dairy sector, and I know that's the way markets work and that's the way forward selling works and so on and so forth. But still, you know, if only 40% of your grain passes, we'll say, for malt, and your average price is 260, I mean, geez, you're taking a significant hit, so we are.
Yeah, and how much is that being sold on for?
Exactly. You
know? So, look, exactly. That's for the IFA and other farm organisations like the Grain Growers and the malting industry, you know, to discuss that. And, you know, if farmers wanted to discuss that to be discussed with the malting industry, then they need to go to the IFA or they need to go to the Grain Growers or whatever, and bring it up, because, and you know, I suppose to ensure malt and barley supply, the price needs to be good, because feed price is good at the minute.
Absolutely. Okay, speaking of feed, Andy, where are we at market wise this week? There's been some more positive developments, I gather.
Yes, Stephen, we've had grain prices rise, I suppose, since we spoke last on podcast. We have Glanbia out this week with prices of 307 for green barley for harvest and 317 for wheat. Derrygold also had prices out, which I think are, if I'm off memory, are a little bit lower. You know, but they're still strong prices and still very much north of €300 a ton. We saw prices weaken. Certainly the rises have stopped for the time being on the futures markets. We have kind of dry wheat for November, December running at 360 and barley at 350, and they form the background to the price offers that are in the market today. So, you know, look, we're looking at prices that are strong, thankfully, for the year ahead so far. Prices today, as we're talking, are strengthening. You know, it had certainly dropped below the 360. It closed on Wednesday night at 356. That's Matif December wheat. As I'm speaking, it's 358.75. So it's moving back up to the 360. So I think it's probably going to sit there for a while until there's another lot of news, one way or the other, that's going to drive it up or down. I'll see rape, for what it's worth, has also got very strong, weakening slightly today, but oilseed rape for November is kind of running at 830 euro a ton. That translates to kind of 780, 790 dry at harvest. You know, they're huge prices by any standards. And I'm saying the difference is in price there is because that's a price onto a boat for export. If we have a lot of rape, and we do, of course, have more winter rape in the UK in the ground. We probably knew that from last autumn, and that's indicative of what Siobhan has been noticing and what I would notice as well. That no matter where you are in a tillage landscape, you're generally looking at lovely yellow fields there at the moment, which seem to be really well structured and extremely clean. And well branched. So I'd look forward with optimism to what's going to happen. Those I'd see the rape crop for growers, and for those who did sell forward a part of their crop at maybe 460, 480, those kind of numbers, perhaps they'll get even more than they thought in terms of average of total yield, and that it will turn out at a bigger price to help the overall average. So that's pretty much what's happening in markets, Stephen.
Okay, Andy, good stuff. We'll move on. Before I do, I just want to give a shout out to My Farming Week in this week's Irish Farmers Journal newspaper, where John and Brian Dunn, Tilly's Farmers from Kildare, are featured. And as always, it's always a good read. Siobhan, Footprint Farmers this week, it's all about plant counts.
Yeah, we're just checking in on plant counts. Look, I think it's good practice to do plant counts, Stephen. You know, it helps you examine your establishment. It lets you check on the drill, and I suppose, you know, check on underperforming parts of the field or discover underperforming parts of the field. We've been doing plant counts on the footprint farms, and look, as we said earlier, from what we're seeing, the plant counts are measuring up to what myself and Andy talked about earlier. Like, establishment is good. We're hitting the 350 plants per meter squared in all fields, if not over it. So yeah, very happy. Just, I suppose, for anyone doing them, I think the easiest way to do it is get your measuring tape. You know, either do it to 50 centimeters or a meter. Put the measuring tape along the row of barley or oats or wheat, whatever it is, and count the plants along one row. The easiest time to do it is now, because you want to do it before the plant starts to tiller. So when it's at like the 1, 2, 3 leaf stage, it's easier to do it. And just, if you're counting along 50 centimeters, multiply that figure by 2, and then you want to multiply it by the amount of rows in a meter. So you need to put your meter stick across the rows of barley and count the number of rows along a meter. So drills will differ. Like, a lot of the drills would have 8 rows across a meter. So so if you had 50 plants along a meter, and then you had 8 rows of barley, you're up to 400 plants per meter squared there, which is very high. But I'm just using that as an example to work it out. So look, it's good practice to do it if you have the time to go out and do it.
Someone will no doubt say, especially some of the newer tillage farmers, say, what's the point on plant counts? What's the significance of understanding establishment rates and whatnot? What difference will it make?
I suppose, in sometimes, and thankfully not this year, you know, your plant count might decide whether you keep a crop or not. You know, not so long ago, some of our winter crops, you know, we had poor winter crops, and plant counts were used to decide whether you reseed the crop or not. But look, it examines how well if your crop didn't establish well, and the plant count is telling you that, you know, you have to say, okay, why didn't my crop establish well? Was it the seed bed conditions? Was it the soil pH? Was the drill working correctly? So is the drill putting out the right seed rate? You know, is there an underperforming part of the field? Why is the plant count lower in this part of the field than that part of the field? So there's loads of reasons why you do them, and I suppose it's good if you keep track of them each year. So, you know, you do them this year and you put them in a diary and mark the field and see how fields differ from one year to the next. So that's the footprints page this week. And I suppose, Stephen, I know you were busy the last few weeks. You have a focus in the paper this week on solar, and you've entitled it, "Is Solar PV Right for You?" And I think that's really appropriate, because people are hearing all about renewables, and you tell them about renewables every week, and you know, they hear about turbines and solar panels, and you know, I suppose they're wondering, should they be doing something, and which one should they be doing? So you've packed this focus with information. I suppose just to start off, you have an explainer there on some of the connections and the schemes, and that you might go through some of that first.
Yeah, thanks Siobhan, and we do, and look, we have been busy over the past few weeks. I've been working with consultants, What Footprint is their name, on a report, an exclusive report for the Farmers Journal, looking into the economics and viability of solar PV systems on Irish farms. Now, you know, I would have covered solar PV quite a bit in the past because of the introduction of the micro generation scheme. The reality is that solar PV is there's a lot in it, and it's so varied dependent on your farm type that realistically, putting in one example of how a solar PV system works on a farm isn't really doing the readers justice, to be perfectly honest with you. So what we've done is we've looked at solar PV across six different scenarios in this report, and it's all contained in this week's Irish Farmers Journal Renewables Focus. Some of the examples which we've looked at, which we can go through now in a minute, is we've looked at solar PV on a 100 cow dairy herd, solar PV on a 300 cow dairy herd, solar PV on a mixed tillage and beef farm, solar PV on a potato farm with cold storage units, solar PV on a pig farm, and then a standalone kind of mini solar farm, kind of an investment piece as such. All of these different examples have different loads, have different requirements, have different kind of connection limitations and whatnot. And it kind of gives you just a flavor of how paybacks and the usefulness of PV varies depending on your farm situation. But as you rightly said, to kind of set the scene, I've done kind of an explainer piece just on exactly where we're at in terms of solar PV and why we're talking about it now. There has been a lot of interest in solar over the past year. To be honest, it's grown exponentially over the past few months because of the increase in energy prices. So basically, first of all, in terms of kind of schemes that are going to incentivize this, we've talked about it quite a bit. The micro generation support scheme, it was formally announced last December, and it's still in the process of getting up and running. But basically what this is, it's going to encourage farmers to install solar systems, solar PV systems, renewable systems, but it's mostly going to be solar, onto their sheds or standalone units or whatever, to try and satisfy as much of their electricity demand as possible on farm, and then export the rest to the grid. So by exporting the rest, the excess electricity produced to the grid, you're going to get what's called a clean export guarantee tariff. So that's basically just the basic wholesale market rate. In other words, you'll get a decent market rate for the electricity which you export to the grid, which was never there before, and that's going to be a legal requirement. But in some cases, you can go a step further and you can get the clean export premium for your excess electricity exported to the grid. And this is a premium price, albeit much lower than the current market rates at the moment. But how long that's going to last, we'll see. The price is 13 cents per kilowatt hour, which is relatively decent. So it is, but you can lock into that for 15 years, and that's guaranteed, which makes a solar PV system a lot more bankable in my book. So that's the scheme at the moment. Some of the other things I've gone through in this article is, well, how do you size a system? So I'm interested. I have a farm here. It's this enterprise or it's that enterprise. How do I know which one is right for me? Well, you have to look at, I suppose, the limiting factors of the solar system, of the farm, which is unique to every farm, and also your actual requirements. So what are your peak loads? And that's generally what you size a solar PV system to, is what's the maximum amount of electricity which you require on your farm. And you try to kind of marry it up with the size of your solar system. So whether it's 11 kilowatt or 100 kilowatt, it just depends on the enterprise. Some of the limiting factors which I've talked about, this is going to be your maximum import capacity, MIC. And that kind of refers to how much electricity can be imported into the farm and by default exported to the farm as well. Not so much a problem if you're using all of the electricity on farm, but depending on the farm and the system, you might want to export a little bit of the excess electricity and get some of this premium price. Well, that's the amount you can export is going to be determined by your MIC, and that's to do with the type of line that you have and transformers and whatnot coming into your farm. Some of the other things as well, which I've ran through, Siobhan, is, you know, what grants or incentives are there. So we've ran through all the available grants at the moment. We have TAMS, which we know of. There's a big problem with TAMS in that the size of the system supported under TAMS, with the exception of pig and poultry farmers, it is quite small and limited. It's only 6 kilowatt for single phase, 11 kilowatt for three phase, and they're quite small by, you know, in terms of generation capacity versus what you'd actually need. But the biggest problem is you can't export any of that electricity to the grid. So for a lot of guys, and especially for the micro generation scheme, it's not really a runner. Some of the other funding sources we looked at is the Better Energy Community grants from the SEAI. You can get up to 30% off the capital cost. That's quite an attractive one. And then for the bigger farms, you have SEAI Exceed funding, which I wasn't overly familiar with before this report. And that's for, that can cover between 30 to 50% of capital costs, but it's in the context of whole system energy upgrades, if you get me. So you mightn't just be installing solar panels. It could be, you know, upgrading refrigeration units and potato stores, or ventilation components on a pig farm or whatever. Then you have other tax benefits such as accelerated capital allowance, which is a little bit complicated, but basically it's a scheme that allows a farmer, a company, sole trader to pay corporation tax in Ireland to deduct the full cost of the equipment from their profits in the year of purchase, and that's quite valuable. And also, if you're VAT registered, you can get VAT back. A couple other bits and pieces as well before we move on, Siobhan. Grid connections I've ran through as well. So under the new ESB grid connection policy for mini generators, which is still in development, will be able to connect the system up to 50 kilowatts in output to your farm, which will be pretty useful for a larger system. The problem is that's still in development, and it's not going to be there until, you know, midsummer onwards, which isn't really much use to guys who want to install solar right now. Planning, there is a big planning reform going on. We're not fully sure exactly when that's going to be implemented and put in place, so we can only work on what we know at the moment. And basically, there are some planned exemptions for farm buildings for solar PV systems. I'll just run through one of them now. A roof mounted solar PV system which does not exceed 50 meters squared or 50% of the total roof area, whichever is lesser, that doesn't require plan permission. But as you'll see in this report, all of them are much, much larger than 50 meters squared. So you pretty much need plan permission for all of the systems featured in this focus.
Okay, yeah. I was glad to see it start, Stephen. I just hear you saying MIC and all this kind of thing. You have a glossary of terms on the front page of the focus there for anyone who's getting a bit stuck or who's new to it, going through it. But as you said there at the start, like, you know, this really is a must read, because you have specific examples done. You know, you have a pig farm there and a potato farm, so we might just run through some of those examples. And I suppose from what I'm hearing, it sounds like it makes a lot of sense to have solar panels in, you know, on potato farms or indeed dairy farms. So maybe you'd run through an example.
You're 100% right, Sean. Basically, where you have a high energy demand, where you have a high electrical load, then it's going to make sense for you to install solar. Where you have a smaller farm with less of a demand or less of a load, and you're relying more on exporting to the grid to make that return on investment, then the economics, they still stack up, as we'll go through in a minute, but they're just not as attractive as the likes of a potato store. So one of the examples, we looked at a horticultural store, quite a large one in fairness, running four potato cold stores, you know, running grading equipment, running a few other buildings as well. This farm that could be using on average about 464,000 kilowatts hours worth of electricity per year. That's a big demand. Their annual electricity bill conservatively would be 116,000 plus VAT per year. You know, main uses, refrigeration, motors, lighting, and a few other bits and pieces. But they are on three-phase connection. They have a large maximum import capacity, MIC, 100 kVA, and also they have a lot of roof space. So it's just ripe for a solar PV system. So in this scenario, we priced, we examined quite a large solar PV array, 125 kilowatt hours. And whenever I refer to the size of a solar PV system in this report, I refer to it as a kilowatt hours peak, so KWP. So that means the peak output from the solar PV system, you know, during maximum generation, like in a midday. So in this system is 125 kilowatt, which is large, and that will require about 938 meters squared upper space. So it obviously needs plan permission. The economics of it, the numbers are quite attractive. So there's no point sugarcoating this. This is a big system. It's going to require substantial capex. The conservative figures for this system is 132,000 plus VAT. Obviously needs planning, that's a cost, and needs grid connection. This one doesn't need a grid connection because we're using all of it on site. Basically, this size of a system would generate about 33% of this farm's electricity requirement. It would also be able to avail of possibly the exceed funding, which is up to 40%, and also Better Energy Communities or Better Energy Communities BEC grant, that's 25%. That brings down the capex quite a bit. In terms of energy savings, so by installing a system, you'll be saving the equivalent of 26,000 per annum. So you would, and based on those savings and based on availing of the grant aid, we can get our payback period. It's fairly simplistic, so it is, but it gives you a damn good indication of what your payback period would be. So without the grant, you'd be looking at 5 years. With the BEC grant, you'd be looking at 3.5 years. And with the exceed grant, you'd be looking at 3 years. It's 3 years to get a return on investment. That is an utter no-brainer.
Absolutely.
And there's, as I say, there's obviously you get the VAT back because you're likely to be VAT registered. You'll avail of ACA. Now, the panel efficiency does decrease over time. We looked at 10-year projections in this report. And like you're chatting about a module efficiency of 100% in year one. By year 10, it drops down to about 96%. So not a substantial drop, but there is a drop there all the same. And that's where the quality of your panels kind of come into play, which we've also covered in this focus. You mentioned dairy farms as well, Siobhan. Well, look, dairy farms, again, solar PV is a no-brainer because you have a relatively consistent, predictable demand and load and peak loads, no matter what kind of a size you're running, a size of a farm you're running. The challenge with dairy farms, though, is that, typically your peak load, so that's the points in the day where, you know, you need the most electricity, is milking. So milking and cooling. And you typically do that morning and evening. But if you look at the peak generation of a solar PV system, it's midday. So if you like, the peak generation, peak demand don't match up. And that's where battery storage comes into play. So for the dairy farms, we looked at a 100 cow dairy farm with a conventional milking parlour. And we also looked at a 300 cow dairy farm with a rotary parlour. In both cases, we factored in battery storage. And there's a couple of other assumptions here and there as well. We looked at an east-west orientation. So in other words, you put some panels on the east sloping side of your shed, shed roof, and then you put the other panels in your west sloping side of your shed. Why do you do that? Well, if you put them all on the east side, you would probably have higher generation, but it would all be targeted towards kind of the earlier part of the day. Whereas if it's on east and west, you kind of capture more throughout the day, albeit just a little bit less, but it matches up with the energy usage of the dairy farm. In both cases, they were able to avail of support, Better Energy Communities, not so much exceed in this one, but they were also exporting excess electricity back to the grid. You know, we looked at exporting 10 to 20% of the system's generate electricity back to the grid. There's a lot more detail on this, which you can obviously have to read the paper to see. But long story short, you know, in both cases, you were looking at a payback period of under 5 years with the grant, or 6.5 years without the grant. And that's still an absolute no-brainer. So it is in my book. You know, the 100 cow dairy herd, for example, we looked at the 40 kilowatt peak system, and that was generating nearly 80% of the farm's electricity requirements.
Okay.
Yeah, no, so an utter no-brainer. And we were only factoring in, you know, an electricity price of a daytime electricity price of 25 cent per kilowatt hour. But I know farmers who are paying nearly 30 cent, you know. Okay. So the higher the cost of electricity, which you're paying for, the lower the return on investment, or sorry, the quicker the return on investment for a solar system. And it's all kind of, again, covered in these examples to give you a flavor of just how it works.
Yeah. So I suppose on a smaller scale then, Stephen, or even on a mixed farm, you know, how does it stack up? Like, you know, where the energy use isn't as high. You know, you have an example of these as well.
Yeah. So again, in this case, like, we looked at a mixed beef and tillage farm. So basically a farm with a low energy requirement. You know, the majority of the annual electricity use is going on lighting of sheds and even a domestic home. But again, they have plenty of roof space. A typical farm like this would have a single phase connection with an average kind of MIC, maximum import capacity, of 15 kVA. So I guess in this example, you're really dependent on generating a return from exporting to the grid. So in this example, in the paper, we've looked at a 30 kilowatt peak system. So you're still using quite a bit on farm. You know, you're nearly satisfying all of your on farm and domestic house electricity requirements, but you're still exporting a considerable 80-90% to the grid. In that case, you would be able to still be able to avail of a grant, probably the Better Energy Communities grant again of 25%. So that would bring, well, look, your equipment cost still substantial for 30 kilowatt or peak systems, 40,000 plus VAT, which is substantial. 25% grant brings it down to about 30,000 or so. But if you're exporting about 90% of what you're producing, you would be able to claim the clean export guarantee for most of it. You'd be generating around €1,000 a year in income from selling that electricity to the grid. But between that and the electricity savings, which you're making on farm or so, you'd actually be saving about, you know, €4,500 per year or so, which means that your payback period with the grant could still be 5 years. Without the grant, could be 7 years. You know, so it's still pretty attractive, if I'm being honest with you.
Yeah. There's like loads of.
Yeah, that example there, you know, that's a lot more applicable to an average farm in Ireland because it's got the single phase. You know, it's got the kind of small import capacity, which a lot of farms would have around the country. You know, so what you're seeing there now is, you know, it's there'll be a lot more examples of this type of a farm and this type of a payback period and an investment than, you know, than the likes of the likes of the potato farm, which we ran through earlier on.
Yeah, and I think on first glance, maybe some of those mixed farms or the smaller farms maybe, you know, weren't even considering it. So, I mean, I think, you know, they definitely need to take a look at this and have a read through. Stephen, you've given us a lot of information there and food for thought. And we want people to buy the paper as well. So we'll let them read the rest of it, I think.
Absolutely. Look, there's more. As I say, there's a really interesting case study as well of a standalone investment piece. You know, that's looking at a developing a mini solar farm yourself, so nothing to do with rooftop solar, nothing to do with satisfying your own electrical load. This is purely to erect solar panels and export to the grid under the micro generation scheme. And yeah, look, you'll have to read the paper, but the results are interesting. And just finally, Siobhan, I will say as well, like, this to me, a lot of this is about reducing your electricity costs. You know, when you have a payback period of 3 years, well, after those 3 years, then you're essentially generating free electricity. So that's the way you got to look at it. But of course, there is the whole carbon saving end of things as well. Yes. And in each example, we looked at you know, how much CO2 you'd actually be saving from displacing that imported electricity. And the likes of that mixed farm we ran through at the end, well, look, you'd be chatting about 73 tons of CO2 over 10 years. So you would, which is substantial. So it is.
Yeah.
Same with the dairy farm, you know, 300 cow dairy farm over 10 year period, you'd be looking at saving 170 tons of CO2. You know, so this is part of the solution. So it is. And now we have the numbers to back it up. As you said, you have to read the rest in this week's Farmer's Journal.
Yeah, absolutely, Stephen. What are we going to next? So are we on the weather yet, or what are we moving
on? We are indeed. And to be honest, I've kind of rambled on there and I've gone a bit over time on my end. So I think we will wrap it up there for another week. So Andy, what are Met Aaron telling us is ahead of us for the week in terms of weather?
Well, Stephen, generally things look good. Look, certainly look much better on the forecast than they have been for the last number of weeks. Most areas of the country are predominantly on zero rainfall for the week ahead. Certainly there are numbers in some of the regions, you know, a 1 mil, a 2 mil or a 3 mil on individual days seems to be related more to showers or the intensity of showers and the risk of showers. So you might never see them. Or you might see a bigger one depending on just how lucky or unlucky you are. But generally speaking, it seems like a forecast that's going to see lots of opportunity to get more field work done. Looking at wind, it's interesting. I think wind speeds are pretty high kind of for the remainder of the week. Now, they may not prohibit spraying, but we're up on 26, 28, 25s in terms of kilometres per hour. And wind predominantly coming out of the east, northeast and southeast for the next week. So that's kind of bringing a chill that's going to stop any major heavy burst of growth. It's interesting if I look at temperatures, kind of the remainder of this week is relatively warm with 14s, 15s, 13s cited as maximum temperatures and 6s and 7s at nighttime. But when we get into next week, it's changing back again. We're looking at temperatures, daytime temperatures in the average forecast, dropping down to 10 to 12 degrees, but maximum by the day and 3 to 4 at night. So, you know, that easterly wind is going to start having its influence. I also note with interest, I pay a particular attention to the monthly forecast that Met Aaron give on their website. And I find it to be quite useful and a really good guide in terms of the kind of conditions that might lie ahead of us. And they suggest the level of accuracy that they think they can give. So sometimes they will not be suggesting anything accurate, and sometimes they will. But what's relevant about it is that as we get into the month of May, it seems like we're going to get much more broken weather, more showers, etc., which is maybe typical, but also awkward for the busy spraying season that lies ahead, and that people may need to pay attention to that.
Okay, Andy. Thank you for that. And there we are going to have to leave it. So from Andy, Siobhan and myself, Stephen Robb, thank you all very much for listening. And until next week, stay safe, stay tillage farming.
We hope you enjoyed this Irish Farmers Journal podcast. You can find all our podcasts at farmersjournal.ie/podcast and on iTunes, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.